Just like I forget exactly what you said, but like, can you say this without saying this? And like something about the spirituality bit. So
Yeah, it was kind of something along the lines of can we talk about self-inquiry, and the intersection of self-inquiry and self-investigation and science without using the word spirituality. That was the sort of the open challenge.
it gets muddy, right? It
It does.
gets really muddy really fast. And even the word spirituality, I feel like there's a natural coupling that happens with religion, right? And then it's kind of all cultural from there, in a lot of ways, I
Yeah,
think.
in the informal poll I ran, first of all, Twitter's in or now X is an interesting place. For all of its downsides, it does, for better or worse, allow you to engage with thousands of people. And one thing I find interesting is running the polls there, and you can put out a poll, for example, what does spirituality mean to you? And I had a few options: religion, self-inquiry, magic, and then other. And 44% of the poll came in at religion, and the second distant second was self-inquiry, and then the others. So as you point out, religion, I think, tends to come to most people's minds when they think about spirituality. Maybe I'll start with more terms that can be ambiguous. And before I jump into these questions, I don't know if you have any thoughts coming into this, or because what I had in mind was kind of rolling through some of the questions I had posed out there, and it'll just give us a way to probe how your experience has kind of unfolded for you. But in doing so, I'm sure we'll hit some of these other topics on the table today.
Yeah, that sounds great. No other really pre I guess, while we're talking about the just the dis like, I know that the word discourse has become a kind of a phenomenon unto itself. But like, whenever there's sort of a discursive inquiry, right? We naturally have a lot of stuff attached to these words, and we have these sort of reflexive relationships in our minds. So I think it is interesting to really kind of be a nit with some of the language, but not to be like too overly pedantic or like professorial or correct anyone, but like just to really acknowledge that, like, yeah, there are these really robust connections that kind of come preloaded in our brains, contingent upon our cultural context. And that, once you sort of drop a word like spirituality out there, that like people have those internal reference points that I think some people, I don't know, I can't speak for everyone, but sometimes they're just a kind of a part of the like wallpaper of our minds, and we don't necessarily always account for them. So doing that sort of inquiry, I think, is really valuable, about the, like, what are the relationships when I say this, you think of that, and really kind of trying to drill down on what some of those that's are sometimes can be useful internally and kind of in
Yeah, and
relationship.
it's a great point. And I guess if there's one aspiration for discussions like these, is to sort of turn people on to the fact that these terms don't reconcile perfectly from person to person. I think sometimes when you hear people discussing this, person A means one thing, person B maybe interprets another, and neither party or one or the other is sort of privy to this discrepancy. And it's a pleasure to talk to people who are sort of aware, using these terms, but also aware that they might not connect in precisely the same way as they connect for them. So, and having these discussions, I hope that can elevate that fact.
That's cool. I
So,
hope so too.
to throw another term out there, the term, the phrase "waking up," very quickly, I'll just talk about what that means for me. And I think the term "waking up," I came to that term. Sam Harris is he's a thinker in this space, certainly, and a practitioner. And he wrote a book called Waking Up, and he has a meditation app called Waking Up. And my entry point was actually the meditation app. I didn't think much about the term itself. I didn't put a lot of thought into it. I just started with meditation and mindfulness practices. And I think what was sort of beginning to happen without me deliberately trying to make it happen is my awareness of my own reality and my perceptions, emotions, everything started to I just tune into that a little more. What I slowly realized is that, waking up is more or less used or can be used synonymously with enlightenment or spiritual awakening, which is much more profound than my simple definition early on. And even now, waking up, I think, can mean a lot of different specific things to specific people. So I guess with that, I'll ask you, how do you connect with that term? Is it something that happened for you prior to having that term, or did it kind of go hand in hand?
Oh, that's a good question. I feel like the waking up kind of language came kind of after, I guess, my sort of journey toward this kind of inquiry. Started probably in my late 20s to I'm in my 40s now. So let's see, that was probably around between 2006 and 2008. I ended, I kind of self-destructed a relationship. That was otherwise a really, really, really good relationship. She was a really great girl. We were happy, but I had this inner sense of kind of not being enough, not being good enough, not being X enough, whatever. And it, I had a lot of cultural stuff that I wasn't ready to settle down. I had to go out and do more and see more and basically, kind of have more relationships or whatever. And so I kind of, after I, unfortunately, I kind of not to use the not to be too on the nose, I woke up to the fact that like what I was doing was going against my interest. I did not actually want to end this, but unfortunately, I had done so much damage that like she was totally just like done with me and again couldn't really buy back in. So that kind of spun me out a little bit, and I was kind of on a self-destructive tear. And one night, I went out with a friend of mine and met up with him. And we had some drinks, and he persuaded me to just stay at his apartment and not drive, which was, thank God, he's a very good friend. He's still a very good friend of mine. And I did not, but I, he went to bed with his partner at the time, and I was just kind of bumming around his apartment. And I, one of the things I tend to do whenever I'm in anyone's space, if there's a bookshelf, I kind of make a beeline for the bookshelf and check out what they're reading. And there was this slim little volume on the shelf. It was a hardcover copy of The Miracle of Mindfulness. And I don't even think it had like the title and the binding. But it was just this slim little book, and I was like, what's this? And I pulled it off the shelf and I started reading it, and it just grabbed me. It just really hooked me, this idea of mindfulness, that there was this ability to just radically drop into this moment and really let go of the past and stop planning for the future. I was in the midst of a, kind of in a job that I didn't love. I didn't see it as a career path. I really wanted a career. I really wanted to be accomplished. And so like my life was kind of in shambles. I found this mindfulness stuff, and I just started kind of employing it pretty on a utilitarian, informal basis, just when I felt like I was getting a little overwhelmed or the thoughts were coming a little too quickly. And I would kind of stop and take a breath and just really rest in the moment. And that was sort of my toehold for a while. And in the course of kind of investigating mindfulness a little more fully, I started reading more about it. I read mindfulness in plain English, started reading a bit more about meditation. And so I just really started on that road. And at the time, I was working with children with developmental delays. And so if you've ever worked with or know of anyone with autism, that a lot of times autism and anxiety really kind of go hand in hand. And so I wanted to try to bring some of these mindfulness tools and techniques to this community. And so I heard like an ad on NPR at one point a few years later for Lesley University's mindfulness studies program. And I called them, I talked with them about kind of my what I wanted my trajectory to be, where I thought I saw myself going in terms of work. And they directed me toward a counseling and psychology program. And I kind of since high school, I kind of had this latent desire to be a therapist. I thought that was what I wanted to do. But my life, like as I mentioned earlier, my life was like kind of in shambles at that point. So I didn't really take myself seriously enough, or I really thought I lacked a sort of maturity to be taken seriously in that way. And who knows if that was actually wisdom or if that was just inadequacy. But anyway, in grad school, I kind of got my first taste of actually like meditating with a group formally. One of my professors would, after class, he would run kind of a informal meditation group. And so I took part in that and just really was able to week to week kind of drop into that space a little more fully. And that kind of got me a little more curious. And then postgraduate school, I really tried to kind of formalize my meditation practice, and doing it alone did not work for me. I just couldn't really gather myself to meditate, regularly and reliably, like every day or every morning. And so, yeah, that from there, grad school meditation group. Let's see what else. And so, yeah, I guess in the course of kind of investigating this meditation stuff a little more fully, then I kind of played around with this idea of like what is enlightenment? What is this waking up? Waking up to the reality, seeing clearly. The other thing that's really I think important to note is that I'm adopted, and thankfully the language has changed. But when I was a kid, when I was coming up, a lot of people would actually use the words like, do you know your real parents, or like, is that your real brother? And so from the time I was like, as long as I can remember, I've been really questioning like what is real? What is this reality? Like they are my real parents. But like if I would say my real parents are Jim and Jean Aylesworth, like they live, the 58 Auburn Street, like I would get like the sideways look, like, oh, maybe being cheeky or whatever. So I think maybe that is sort of the first entryway into kind of the understanding that like the subjective reality that all of us experience as people is really, really contingent upon the cultural context in which we're kind of embedded. And that if you were to take the same sort of raw material of our personhood and shift it a little bit and put it like, even in another state, right? And like, if I grew up in Vermont, I'd be a dramatically different person than I am now, like growing up in Massachusetts. And so, that's a really long-winded answer, and I'm not sure that that really even got at your question, but I guess to me, the waking up bit is really just waking up to the fact that like our entire kind of personhood is really, really fungible and really dependent upon the context that we're in. And I mean, that's another one of those glaringly obvious things that once you say it, it's like, oh yeah, of course. But I don't think enough people really kind of
Yeah.
sit with that and really allow it to really kind of penetrate their understanding
Yeah,
of
no,
themselves.
there's a few that was great, and there's a few things I can comment on. I mean, to where you ended, first of all, I think that definition is as good as anyone as far as waking up is. I mean, I think I feel very similar in terms of how I one thing I notice in this quote unquote spiritual terrain is some things can sound really abstract. I mean, when you get into Zen koans or it can sound like a riddle, or you might hear claims that are just impossible to know if you've actually done it or not, and it feels like people sort of start spinning out in circles, wondering if they've done this it, whatever it is. But when you phrase
Yeah, did I have the right experience, right? Like,
But when you phrase it that way, I mean, it still might be it still might be hard. It's, because you can hear something like waking up to the fact that our personhood is fungible. That's what you said, and I think that's great. And someone can hear that and process it conceptually
Yeah.
and still not feel it, but at least it's a very approachable way to put it. And it's as best as I could do myself. It's, you take yourself to be sort of this concrete thing, or close to concrete thing, this thing that doesn't change much moving through the world. And then you start to recognize, oh yeah, cultural conditioning is a big thing, or my experience with XYZ is a big thing, or my attachment to a dream is this thing. And that drives that personhood. And then the more you sort of pull those threads, the more the personhood sort of can evaporate.
Yeah.
And I think your other comment was it seems in general, not many are to I can't think of a better word right now, awoken to that impermanent aspect of selfhood, of personhood. And I guess that's one of my motivations is, because I think as a consequence, and this is for me, and you can share
Yeah.
how it was for you, as a consequence of realizing how fungible personhood is, it's sort of humbles me. It makes me move through the world with a little less conviction that opinions are definitely right, or that I do understand someone else. Instead I say, well, I don't know if my feelings about this or that are right, and I don't know what that person's worldview is like, because I see how impermanent mine is. And it's a wonderful effect it's had on me to move through the world with a little more grace, I suppose. And then I think, well, wouldn't it be wonderful if more people could similarly see that their personhood is not so concrete, and it might help them understand other people as well. And that seems to be the tricky bit, is so just to try to put that more succinctly, if only everybody could wake up to the fungibility of their personhood, wouldn't that be a great thing?
I mean, yeah, because you hear it all the time, right? Like when people are like, well, that's just who I am, or that's how I am, that's how I'm wired. You know, I hear that constantly. That's just how I'm wired. It's like, well, yes, and the wiring is under your control. We are, you know, even our brains, they're plastic. We can build new grooves. We can, really choose whether or not. And yes, that the habit energies that we have, the conditioning that we have, it is really strong. You know, it is not exactly easy to just put down these fundamental tenets of like who we think we are. But to me, to my mind, it is eminently worth it, kind of as you say. Like, it does afford you just the to relax around that is to me kind of a gift to give yourself. Like, you don't have to do the thing if you don't want to anymore.
Whatever that thing happens to be.
Whatever it is, you know, we all have things that, you know, that we're chasing, that we're craving, or that we're avoiding, you know. And it's like, if you can actually suspend that faculty a little bit, and create that little bit of daylight, you know, I like to use the language, I think I used it earlier in the conversation, of like a toehold. You know, it doesn't, you don't need too much to really kind of scale the wall of personality. But you know, if you do, I think you can get a clearer view of really how, to your point, how you want to be in the world.
Just to go through some of your, because it sounds like maybe one of the first bits of your toehold was walking up to that bookshelf and seeing Miracle of Mindfulness. I don't know if you can remember this easily, but how, when you were looking at that book, was something sort of immediately apparent to you, or did you actually have to do some sitting to sort of for it to click? And then if it was the second one, I mean, what? Because you can think about someone picking up a book like that and just opening up a few pages and skimming it and putting it right back down again. So What is it about skimming those pages that sort of drew you in? Do you think it was the circumstances of your life at the time?
Yeah, I think it was the that's a good question. I mean, it did immediately strike me. I think because it was so divorced from the path that I had been on, you know, this path of preparation in our culture where, I mean, even now you can read about these people like paying like, you know, 5-digit figures to send their kid to the right preschool. You know, so in my life it was very much like go to school. You have to go to school to get it, and you have to do well in school. You have to do good all the way from first through eighth to get into the good high school. And from the high school, you have to do good in high school to get into the good college. And then you had to do well in college to get the right job, because you need the right job to get the right partner, and you need the right partner to have the right life. And so it's, you know, and on top of that, you know, we were not a wealthy family, so I had to do really well in school to try to get the scholarship so I could afford to go to a good school. So in my life, it had always been about just like getting ready for the next thing, prepare, 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 prepare. You know, and really perform my way into earning a life. And, you know, the message that I could just stop and radically drop into and enjoy the tangerine that was in front of me, or just wash dishes to wash dishes. I remember really being struck by that, the two reasons for washing dishes. You know, one is to have clean plates off of which to eat. The other is to simply stand at the sink and marvel at all of the circumstances that led you to that sink, and really be with the activity of washing the dish and feeling the sponge and feeling the dish in your hand and the water over, you know, the water running over your fingers. And, you know, the idea that I could actually just do that was just so fundamentally radical to me that I just had to keep reading, that I was like, wait, what? What do you mean? This runs counter to everything that I had been doing. I couldn't even relax into an otherwise loving relationship. I always had to have a little bit more. I always had to like really prove, was she it? Was she gonna, you know, like, and it's just, you know, the fact that like someone was saying, no, you get to drop it. You just get to drop it all, and exist for a moment. That was just such a breath of fresh air that I wanted to keep taking those breaths. And I just kind of stayed the course with it. And yeah, it's been eminently fruitful for me.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, the fact that just the concept was so radically different from the reality you were familiar with, that was a hook for you to kind of pull your interest in and then nurture it into, practice and just more contemplation. I guess it makes me think of another thing. If you think about what might interest people in this, I wonder if they didn't have, this day-to-day life where or conditioning throughout their lives where they were expecting the next thing, or they had all these sort of, they were burdened with all these aspirations that were stacked on top of one another. That gives someone, so you in your case, and I can relate to that as well. It gives you a relative position to appreciate the opposite from, which is just, hey, let go of that and appreciate what's here right now. So I guess it makes me wonder, how might someone who doesn't live in that sort of one extreme appreciate the other? I wonder if one sort of needs to feel that extreme of questioning and anticipation and wondering if they could gain more. I wonder if, in the absence of that, someone could really appreciate mindfulness, for example. It's sort of an open question. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I mean, that's a good question. I guess, you know, kind of taking it from the opposite tack, right? Like if you're really kind of listless or directionless, or, you know, you don't have any kind of ambitions, right? Or you feel totally blocked off or walled off from the world. I could see how, personally speaking, I could see how kind of just allowing yourself to actually kind of drop into a different space and actually kind of gin up a little bit of motivation or a little bit of ambition. Because, I guess the media likes to make a lot of hay about how like millennials are lazy, and like I don't think anybody's necessarily. I think laziness is sort of an invention. I don't really believe in it. I think we all crave purpose. None of us really want to work, I don't think. No one wants to toil away at someone else's dream, but most humans want something out of this corporal world, like we all, I think at least, but sometimes there are those faculties that kind of going back to this idea of personhood, like, oh, I'm not up for that. I that's for someone else. I can't do that. So I don't know if that, I'm not sure if that, something like mindfulness would be kind of an enough or enough of a toehold for someone who is otherwise kind of wandering or lost in a different way than I was. I was almost kind of the world was almost too open. There were just too many options. I kind of couldn't choose. I couldn't just settle into like a path. And so yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
I appreciate what you just said about it, and there is still an openness to the question, so maybe that'll just linger as a question in my mind and to think about further. So basically, it started as you picked up the book, and it was so divorced from your reality. It drew you in. You started your practice, and then you started in more group settings, would you attribute sort of, because I mean, it sounds like you're at a place where that concept and then those practices ultimately led you to kind of get a good feeling about the fungibility of your personhood. Do you remember that like ever striking you very vividly, or was it gradual, or both?
I think it was sort of it was sort of the cart before the horse, to be honest. Like if any, yeah, I guess if anything, it was sort of a gradual kind of dawning of like, I'd say it's probably more gradual. Like I want to say it was kind of always there in a way, but kind of like if almost like I like to talk about how, when you begin speaking, you don't always know the last word of the sentence that you're going to speak, but as you start talking, the words sort of come and they fill themselves in. And, there was sort of this, the bone was there in thought, but then as you speak, you really put the meat on it, and you kind of land where you need to. I think because of my experiences, there was sort of that bone of, fungibility, as we're talking about. That was there, that I understood that, like, if the papers had been shuffled a different way on someone's desk, that I would have went to a different family and I would be a fundamentally different person. But like the possibility of it still being on the table for like there to be some robust change, I'd say that kind of that did, I think that came about as a course of in the course of practice, in the course of really trying to drill down on some of these bedrock elements of our psyche and our psychology and our identity.
Now,
As I mentioned, I did, oh, go ahead, please.
I was when you started to boot up into these practices and maybe terms and some of these communities, did it actually rev up a new sort of seeking, so to speak, where you were kind of wondering everything you maybe didn't know? Because that's kind of the paradox of it, right? Is like mindfulness, whether it's the book you picked up or whether you hear someone speak about it or something like that. It says, oh, wait a minute, this is a different version of reality than the one I know. Now I want to know as much about that as I possibly can. Did you pick up that sort of energy at all in your way, or did it feel like it was a did it feel great from the get-go and just got you to where you were?
There was a lot of inquiry. There was a pretty good amount of like, what is this? Like, what's happened? Like,
Yeah, and I'm not sure that's
I was,
avoidable. I had the same, only I say that only because I had a very similar experience.
I like to say the a book Buddhist for a very long time. I just kind of read about these practices and like kind of where they came from and like what is the utility of just sitting there? Come on, give me a break. Like what how can that be like a useful like how can that be a good use of my time to just sit there and like stare at the wall or whatever? So I was kind of a tough sell. I really and I was pretty anti-religious because of my experience as a Catholic and with witnessing kind of the abuses of the Catholic Church. I was a tough sell on religion per se. And being that mindfulness is directly it's sort of it is a religious an inherently religious practice in my mind. I do think it's a little I do take issue with the psychotherapy community as they sort of just pluck out mindfulness from its greater context and try to like technicalize it and like presented in this kind of cordoned off way. I don't to me it's the pinnacle of colonization, but I'm not one to sort of poke the eye of the Dalai Lama, and I guess the Dalai Lama kind of gave people permission to do that. Like if people will benefit from it and they don't want it to be called Buddhism, don't call it Buddhism. But to me that just rubs me a little bit. I chafe at that a bit. I
Which
think it's just
is
a
seeing what rubs you is seeing mindfulness outside of a context. So, for maybe for example, using it to relax. Is that a good example?
Yeah, oh yeah. Like I what really gets me is like the corporatization, like the Google coming in and having its employees practice mindfulness so they'll be more productive. Like
Sure.
that stuff really sends me.
Yeah. One question I sort of try to I aim this at almost anything is you can just pick a blank and we'll say mindfulness, and then I follow that with in service of what, and it's sort of a prompt for me to really dig into okay, that Google example was a great one. If they're applying mindfulness there to sort of help the bottom line, so to speak. I mean, if there are greater aspirations for all the individuals at the company, and that's truly the intent of Google, then that's wonderful. But if it is more explicitly like, hey, we just want to keep our employees happy and retain them, and it's more business driven, then that would be less admirable, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. I like that in service of what?
Yeah, that's where I sort of tack that on. Not to change topics, but I can't remember when it was exactly. It might have been 2007 or 2008. Roland Griffiths from Johns Hopkins came out with his psilocybin research about, these were folks who had terminal cancer. They, had months to live, sometimes clinically untreatable depression. And, psilocybin mushrooms were able to give them peace or take them out of the place they were stuck in. And now, what I find sort of fascinating, I mean, that just establishing that capability is pretty wild. And just that potential is very wild. And I think the world, I see the world still trying to make sense of that potential. So again, I say, okay, psychedelics in service of what? And, it seems like it makes people more creative. It makes people maybe feel a little better as they're going about their day. I think all that, I actually don't have a problem with that, but I do wonder if, you can plant that in a context that kind of gets at some of this, I guess I can say self, perception of self or reality. But I can't help but wonder that, because so just to circle back and say that again. So mindfulness in service of what? So similarly, I say psychedelics in service of what? And then I sort of tack that onto the other things. And one topic there is psychedelics. I don't know if you have any experience with that you're comfortable sharing. But then the second topic is just sort of trying to put all of these under the same context, if such a thing were possible, and seeing how there's synergies across these things.
I mean, I do have some experience with psychedelics. I have taken psilocybin on a few occasions, and I have found an expansiveness to be a part of it. And I did have a bad trip one time where I was like wandering around Brookline barefoot at like 3:30 in the morning, convinced that I had died and this was hell. Because I don't really love
Wild.
being cold,
Yeah.
right? So I was like, hell is actually cold. It was like October or November. I was just like, I was tripping out with a bunch of people and they all got tired and went to bed and I was still up and I don't know how, but I decided I would leave because I, in my yeah, in my psilocybin-addled mind, I had they weren't just in the other room sleeping. They had left existence, and I was
Wow,
in this other
wow.
plane. But that was that. Yeah, that was still. Yeah, that was an interesting night. I
Was
remember.
that just to sort of map this onto your timeline you were talking about, was that before your sort of mindfulness and meditation journey? Was it in the middle somewhere?
It was in the middle, actually. I remember I kept asking people, are you the Buddha? Are you the Buddha? Are you the Buddha? Like, so yeah, I was that was when I was probably in my let's see, when was that? That was I was working as a bartender at the time. So that was probably in around 2009. Yeah, that was probably around 2009, 2010.
So,
Yeah.
you can share if this was the case, but perhaps the at least after the fact, because during, I'm sure you thought exactly all those things, and they were literally that powerful. But then, after the fact, maybe the mindfulness practice helped you put that into, integrate it, so to speak, to put it into perspective. Was that the case for you?
That's hard to say. I'm not, I'm not really sure. I remember what I really took away from that night was the profound kindness of a stranger, of a cab driver. I was working as a bartender at the time, and what had happened was I went to the bar to pick up my tips from like the 2 nights before. Like basically, like we'd they would. There were two bartenders on, and one would stay and close, and one got cut earlier, and they could go home. You just have to come back later and get your money after, like, the other bartender closed out and tipped out and did all that jazz. So I went back one night to get my tips, and then I went to go and buy some. I went to go to, called up my guy to pick up some pot, and he was in the middle of like, hey, we just took some mushrooms. Come by if you want. And so I did, and I went over there, and I had a big wad of cash on me. I had like a probably like $450 or something, which was a lot of money for me at the time. But I remember while I was tripping, I was wandering around thinking I was dead, thinking that I was in hell. And eventually I started to kind of come to as like the night wore on and I walked more and more, and then like I walked into a part of the city where that was a little more active, and like I saw a cab, and I kind of came to, and I kind of realized a little bit about like what I was doing, but I didn't know where to go back to. I didn't quite know where this kid's house was, and so I'm kind of still tripping out. I somehow get in this cab, and I remember his name. His name is Santiago. Santiago is a saint. I still have a lot of affection for
Wow,
Santiago
wow.
to this day. And I was just like, Santiago, who are you? And he's like, I'm Santiago. Who are you? I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, I have no idea. And I was like, do you need this? I don't need this. I don't have any money. I'm dead. I don't need this anymore. And I tried to give him like 400 something dollars. I just was like, take it. I don't need it. And he was like, no, sir, no, I can't do that. Where are you going? Where are you going? And I was like, I don't know, Santiago. Where are you going? The patience of that man. I just remember, and like eventually he drove me around Brookline for long enough that I got my bearings, and I was like, oh, that's it. Okay, and like he got me back to the where I needed to be. I paid him appropriately. I did not give him all my money. But he didn't take the money from me, and that I just remember being so moved by that after the fact that like
Yeah.
I really wanted to like try to put some of, I don't know, I was just so struck by that profound kindness, that he did not, this person just did not take advantage of me, and they actually really devoted a little bit of their time to try to get me back into this world.
Yeah.
And so
Yeah.
that was actually kind of the biggest takeaway for me, all of mindfulness and everything aside, was that ethical piece of his behavior that was just so moving to
Yeah,
me.
it was sort of a very powerful data point in your mind there forward about how kind someone can be and how meaningful that can be. Yeah, that's great. Just kind of go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Oh no, I was just saying that was just that really did inspire me to try to put more kind of that energy out into the world,
Yeah,
to
yeah.
kind of just look after other people when they're suffering, when they're spun out.
Yeah. Or in any context, really. Like any, it's hard because if you say I want to help people who are suffering, well, there's 8 billion people who are probably suffering in some capacity. So where do you even start? But even so, to have that as a sort of a go-to impulse when you see it and when it connects with you, and that's a really great thing. Just to
Well,
pay it
and
forward.
just to start with kind of who gets in your metaphorical cab, right? Like who's in your space, who's in front of
Yes,
you in
right.
that moment, right?
Yes, yep.
That was kind of I guess that was kind of a takeaway too, that like that guy, he's not going to save the world, but he saved my world that night in a way, he really
Yes.
helped me. And it left a mark on me, like I still remember his name. Like, can't really remember his face, but I remember his name, and I remember his little accent, and I just remember that humble act of really profound kindness and care.
Yeah. Do you think, I don't know if you spend any time thinking about this. I mean, it's kind of not necessary because the fact is it did leave a powerful impression on you and seems like a very positive one. Do you ever wonder if psychedelics sort of put you in any state to sort of very deeply appreciate what was happening there? Like, when I ask this question, I also think about, in the clinical contexts, what they sort of speculate is that, our minds have all these priors, whether it's an experience or, memories or, just past experiences that our brain uses to sort of respond to just life in general. And psychedelics sort of loosen those priors, so to speak, and kind of leaves you open and exposed to more of that. The raw experience. So, do you think psychedelics perhaps let that hit maybe more deeply than it would have? There's also the
Probably.
it's all there's
Yeah,
also
go ahead.
the psychedelics also put you into the situation where he would have the only reason he responded with such kindness is you were sort of living in temporarily in a different world where it seemed reasonable to give him all your money because you didn't need it anymore. So there's that element
Visibly
too.
impaired, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of, I was pretty clearly a wounded bird in that moment. My wing was not working properly,
Yeah.
so I think it probably did inspire some care. But I
Yeah.
think the word you said that really does it for me is that openness, right? That really it just allows you to have an expansiveness of your mind. And I'm not sure what. Yeah, I like what you had to say about how it sort of can help you sort of dissolve some of those priors a little bit and tap into the more expansive nature of, I know, the consciousness bit. I'm making air quotes, but yeah, like, I mean, I do think that there is something to that, I don't know if it's cosmic or whatever, but I do think that there is an openness that comes with psychedelics that's hard to,
Makes
I, yeah, go ahead.
it makes experiences such as that, or maybe such as the ones that are spoken about in some of this clinical literature possible.
Yeah, I guess what's coming up for me is the concept of the storehouse consciousness in Buddhist psychology and philosophy. I think it's the Alaya Vijnaya. That basically, there's this faculty in our consciousness that contains kind of the wholeness of everything, and that it's through our action and through our karma and through our behavior that really allows elements of this Alaya Vijnaya to kind of come out into reality and bring itself forth. And I don't, yeah, I guess in as we're talking, what I would put forth is that, I think you're kind of onto something, that like psychedelics may help kind of tap into that expansive possibility that exists kind of on a I don't know what the proper like unconscious or unrealized level.
Yeah, it's somewhere available to access, and it's I don't like reference to psychedelics. It just makes it seem like a magic button that zaps you into such a place. But I do think it makes people more open to it.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. It's not guaranteed, but if you do get on that, if you do get on that path, it is possible to get there, but
Yeah,
it's not a,
I always also like to acknowledge that psychedelics aren't necessary to get there. I mean, the nice thing about mindfulness is it does achieve, one of my favorites is t them taking, I think it was fMRI scans of experienced meditators, in measured by decades of experience, and then also looking at the brain on psychedelics. And in both cases, they see that the default mode network sort of shut down. While I think it's very interesting to look at psychedelics and see how they function, I also find it nice to acknowledge that they aren't necessary, but it does give a glimpse or a window into what might actually be happening in our brains and minds in these contexts.
I'm inclined to agree with that.
One other, we spoke a little bit about mindfulness, and maybe one quick question too, just to sort of tie it back. Buddhism, I similarly sort of read a lot, and part of that was reading about Buddhism. I almost feel fortunate that maybe it was just the right time and awareness of things. I picked up Robert Wright's book, Why Buddhism Is True. And that gave me this great opportunity to deeply admire Buddhism, and not sort of get, because Buddhism is so old, and there's all these different factions and interpretations. And what I liked about Robert's book was that he sort of tried to describe the essence of it as a non-Buddhist, but someone who really wanted to sincerely see what it was all about, and that helped me appreciate Buddhism, but also sort of, not keep it at too far of a distance, but not quite be inside of it. So I'm just curious, how was your relationship with Buddhism, in terms of formal practice, and where does that sit today with you?
My first thought was with Buddhism, it's important to remember that there isn't just one Buddhism, there are
Right.
Buddhisms,
Yes.
and that each culture it encounters, the culture changes it and it changes the culture a little bit, at
Yes.
least as far as I can tell in my research and understanding. But
Yes.
right now I practice from a Zen tradition, and I took over the course of the pandemic, I took a course, a postgraduate certificate course in meditation and psychotherapy. And one of the presenters was like, the Buddha, I think it was Andrew, I think it might have been Andrew Alinsky, was like, the Buddha never said, meditate in a room alone. It was always kind of presented in this kind of community-based thing, the third jewel is the Sangha in the Buddhist teaching, so it was kind of a call to action to me to kind of just buy in somewhere, and as I said, I chafe a bit at the secularization of mindfulness and meditation. I kind of I don't know why I just bristle at that a bit. I think if it works for you, fine, but it just doesn't quite work for me to divorce it so thoroughly from the context in which it was derived. So I do practice from a Zen tradition. I've been doing that for a couple of years. Actually, over the course of the weekend, I took part in a Zen ceremony called Jukai, where you receive the Bodhisattva precepts and you make a public vow to try to live those precepts out. And they're When you say precepts, I think people reflexively think of commandments, and they're not necessarily commandments, but I spent a while with a teacher kind of in a group setting, kind of talking about these precepts and how to sort of apply them practically and holistically to your life. So I did bite the bullet. I am practicing within a religious, very overtly religious context, despite kind of my own reservations and misgivings about it. I think it's, I do think it's important to, like I say, kind of not completely divorce it from the context. And
And
at a, you know, I
it
don't know.
sounds like you do so with very clear eyes. I mean, I can relate to the early Catholicism aspect of things, and I know for me anyway, I was thrust into that context without, without opting into it. I was just kind of in it, and then it was a process to sort of, as I got older, to slowly question things and distance myself from it, and looking at what you just described for yourself, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing it's not dogmatic in the same way that, say, a Catholicism would. And, I too acknowledge that community. I mean, frankly, that's why I'm here today. And is community I see is so essential, because as you say, you can be in alone in a room and have insights. And if they do help you personally, individually, that's wonderful. But we do live in a big world together, and community is sort of what allows us to weave values and behaviors and conduct that sort of, as best as possible, serve everybody. So I do see community as so essential. And it sounds like you're able to access the community, that essential community, this way.
Yeah, I really did try to kind of suspend my kind of inherent bias against it, and just really kind of try to take it as what it is. It's a community of people who found something that resonated for them pretty deeply, and that
Yes.
and Zen is about, in my mind, Zen is about relationship, how you relate to the objects in the world, right? And part of Zen is really about the teacher and student relationship, and kind of not deifying the teacher and not thinking that they're some sort of other level kind of being, but they're on the level ground that you are as a human, and they're doing their best to kind of figure out what it means to kind of live out these pillars of Buddhism, the pillars of Zen, the ethical behavior, the concentration and wisdom, and to kind of see that and kind of glean from their experience. My teacher is a really experienced practitioner, and one of the ways that I kind of slowly but surely bought into Buddhism was I encountered at a I was at a conference one time, and one of the speakers talked about a book written by Norman Fisher called Training in Compassion, as that interpretation of Tibetan mind training, Lejeune. And I read Norman Fisher's book. It really resonated with me, and he has a podcast that he puts out, where he puts out his Dharma talks, and I used to listen to those on my way home on my commute. I was at the time I was working. I had a pretty decent commute. It was like 45 to 50 minutes, and so kind of a perfect window of time to absorb a Dharma talk. And what better vehicle for practice than sitting in traffic or navigating the roads of Massachusetts? So
Yes, yes.
listening to Norman Fisher just really humanly express these things in, as you say, kind of this really kind of non-dogmatic, very human way, really helped to ease my kind of reflexive aversion to the organized bit about the organized religion, and kind of helped me just dip my toe in. And once I did with this group and with this teacher, it was the water felt fine, and it didn't kind of raise my hackles at all, and so I kind of stuck with it. Yeah, I've been with the with this community for a couple of years now, and just a
Yeah,
lovely, lovely group of people.
it sounds great, sincerely.
Yeah.
I just sort of going through the different angles on all of this. Is there any art or fiction that has been in your life that added to your insight, or I guess when I say insight, I'll just keep referring back to this central insight, the fungibility of personhood, and then all the sort of cascading insights that might flow from there. But as you've sort of gone down this path, so to speak, is there any fiction or art that sort of connected with you along the way?
I think the first one that comes to mind is a book by Kurt Vonnegut, The Sirens of Titan. I don't know if you've ever read it.
No, not familiar. I've heard of Vonnegut, but not that. I'm not familiar with that book.
I'm pretty it's one of his I think it's one of his lesser known works, but I personally really, really loved it. It's do you mind if I give you a little spoiler?
Yo, please, please do.
One of the thrusts, main takeaways of the book is this bit about how the basically there's a like this cosmic war that gets set off, that there's like this colony. This person, this one guy, has this ability to kind of take this spacecraft or what have you, and kind of traverse all of space and time. And he creates this little colony on Mars that's like set to invade Earth. And they go through and they invade, but it's this army of like elderly women and children, and like these other kind of re really vulnerable beings that come down and attack Earth. And all sorts of things happen. But one of the main takeaways of the book is that this, after this war, this community crops up with this really fundamental kind of tenet of not taking advantage of anyone ever, and almost basically handicapping themselves to kind of make sure that there is like this kind of level kind of playing field of humanity, that like no one's gonna like really kind of work to consciously like outperform anyone in this really unhealthy way. I think there's a time and a place for healthy like intra-group competition, but in my mind, the way we do it, and the winner take all, and like if you don't work, you just go die, kind of a vibe, really doesn't sit well with me. And so that piece of art about like really kind of being conscious about like not taking advantage of anyone, was really pretty moving for me, because I think a lot of our culture is sort of like, do whatever you need to do at
Zero
any,
sum.
yeah, right? Like, I'm gonna win, and for me to win, you need to lose. Sorry, that's just the way the game's played. And I think there's room for everyone to win. I don't like operating from that scarcity mindset. I do prefer to kind of think of there be as being an abundance. And maybe that's folly. I don't know. But I just, yeah, again, I kind of bristle a bit at the zero sumness of a lot of how we operate. So yeah, that's one piece that was really moving for me.
I like that a lot. And I also like the idea of plenty for everybody. One thing, it's just as an aside, one thing that is limited is sort of the capacity of resources on the earth. And occasionally I just I guess it's not hard nowadays to look at climate or, impact on the ocean or deforestation or, a laundry list of things and say, as individual people, we use and consume seemingly way more than we need. That in a perfect world, you'd wave a wand and, there'd be a mass mindset change and we could be efficient and caring and distributive and not non-zero sum. And then, in parallel to that, I just do acknowledge that there is a limited set of resources, and at least in how we behave today as a species on the earth. And those that seems like a slow collision that we're, I don't know how to resolve that, and I'm not sure that there's much to talk about there, other than I agree with both things, and that there is plenty for everybody. Yet on the other hand, we have this precious resource of the earth, and I'm just trying to figure out how we can all manage it together.
Well, yeah, and kind of in line with the taking advantage bit, let's not take advantage of the planet. Let's not pretend that it is this sort of inexhaustible resource, as you say. I mean, I think you can sort of be forgiven for like looking at a forest and being like, there's no way we can get through all of that. But I think the sheer scope of how many of us there are, I think it's hard for us to really grasp. Like once we get past a certain point, numbers are just like, kind of concepts. It's like, oh, well, yeah, like 8 billion, what's that, what does that even mean? But like, yeah, you think of 8 billion people all thinking that they are the center of the universe, and it gets really, really gnarly really fast.
This sort of segues into what I ultimately think a lot about, and it's a tricky thing, as we've talked a lot about so far, which has been great, is that some of these practices and insights, they sort of knock a person back, and at least that was how it worked for me. It made me appreciate so much more with so much less, and it's re been really consistent. I mean, it would have been one thing for me, say in 2021, to say, "Ah, yeah, this is how I feel." It's sort of a wild shift, but now, almost 3 years later, it's still here. So, still appreciating so much more with so much less. So then, I say, "Well, we do live in a world of 8 billion and growing, and how?" How could, and this is a very hard question, that's my preface. How can such a set of practices or insights propagate? How is that possible? Because nobody likes being, certainly, likes rules being imposed upon them, or likes justification being imposed upon them. So then the needle, the thread, if there really is a needle, that could be a mistake for me to think there is one. But the needle to thread is, how can then these things, again, it's a combination of sort of insights and values and conduct, how can this possibly propagate widely? And I don't know if you have an answer to that. It's just, I'm just sharing, that's sort of an open question I have.
Yeah, and it's a I think it's the million-dollar question, right? Like how do we as people kind of I guess kind of distribute the wealth kind of like these practices, these concepts, these shifts, and really allow people to see that like, they're yes, it is, I think, in a way kind of radical, but it's not so radical that it's like unattainable or that it's gonna make you kind of not, I don't know, not be kind of who you are. Granted, that's kind of the point, but it, like, and paradoxes abound in all of this, right? It's very subtle and like, it really, as I like to say, it really puts the B in subtle at some of these things because they kind of don't make, a lot of it's like, wait, what do you mean? Like, so yeah, I love that question. And I don't necessarily pretend to have an answer.
No, I really appreciate your response, because it's about the best I can do too. And again, explains, what I love about today. And again, want to thank you for jumping on, is I do think conversations are powerful, and to the extent anybody might listen to this, even if it's just you and I talking, that's wonderful. But to the extent anybody can hear a conversation such as this one and maybe get curious, that seems like a beautiful thing, potentially.
Yeah, I really thank you for kind of putting this out into the world, because I think it is a valuable inquiry, and I think to do so in the way that you're doing it is really cool. Yeah.
Maybe, do you feel like you have, again, these words, we'll try to reconcile as best we can. Do you feel like your insights are somewhat stabilized? Do you ever get the sense that there's more to learn and more to integrate, or do you feel sort of, content with your view and how it's sort of settled in, throughout all this time? How does that feel to you nowadays?
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel To me, like to stand with certainty in any position is sort of
Yeah, that's, I love where you're going already.
you know that
Certainty is the sort of thing to be allergic to.
you know so
Doesn't feel
I
right.
really like resting in that kind of ground of not knowing and really
Yeah, no, that's great.
you know applying that ethic of like, well, I'm not sure, like where does this go, and to kind of keep pulling at the string and to kind of keep treading the path and just kind of see where it goes, because I do think there is hopefully you know to kind of go with the theme, the expansiveness of it, that you know I think it'll things will keep opening and keep ripening, and maybe we will get to that
Now,
point. Yeah, go ahead.
at the same time, I'm guessing it's not an anxious energy. So you can be comfortable with the openness of the question and continue to investigate and pull the strings, but not feel anxious about it. Is that fair?
That is very fair. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, and I only think of that and mention it because I can remember my own energy sort of going down this. I think we both acknowledged this a little earlier. Is there's tons to read and tons to figure out, and you're really trying to rapidly figure out all the things you're sort of ignorant to. And I happily, I can't remember the last time I felt that way exactly. Yet my curiosity is still quite alive and keeps me going and investigating and reflecting and contemplating.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, it's really refreshing to me, you know, to have this feeling of like, well, you know, I'm not really sure. Let's see where this goes. And to not
Yeah,
really be too
both
stressed about
things.
the destination, right?
Yeah.
You know, that it doesn't,
Yep.
you know, it doesn't go anywhere, that this is just it, that you know, it gets to keep
Yep.
kind of refreshing. And yeah, I like the word ripening, you know. That kind of and you know life is such that it's going to keep coming, that you know the curveballs are out there, you know, and they're going to come for me, and to draw on these practices to kind of sit with the more challenging elements that are bound to come up in the course of my lifetime, you know. Right now I'm healthy and able-bodied, and you know so is you know my partner, and that is not going to be the case forever. You know, life is going to test me, and so how can I relate to those tests in a sort of you know more open way, and not get so caught up in the, as a, you know, as I say, the reflexive kind of responses to what happens to us, to the suffering that we do have to endure in these bodies, in this existence that we cohabitate in.
Yeah. Peace sits in tension with uncertainty, and it's that uncertainty and the peace sort of tugging on each other and finding nice harmony between the two.
I like that.
On that uncertainty, more for fun question. When you think about the material world and where science is, and we're trying to explore consciousness and maybe other mysteries, material reality versus the reality of the mind. Are there any sort of, in a scientific context, are there any mysteries that you have as favorites, or do you sort of just let those all play out, and you're kind of happy to just stay with your insights and your journey?
Oh, that's a good question. I like to sort of sit with what is the force that drives time? You know, like the mystery of time for me. I think that is something that doesn't necessarily go anywhere for me. Like I'm constantly curious about you know, like I guess I kind of on a cursory level, I kind of understand the physics of it, sort of, I think. But really, like, what is this sort of the I like to sort of sit with sort of the bedrock elements of our lives that we all sort of kind of take for granted, like like gravity, right? Like we
Yeah.
all just sort of have this thing about like gravity existing, and like, you know, it's this force that keeps us rooted on this rock spinning through space. But like really, like kind of going back to the original thing of like the black box kind of hallucinogen machine that we're all kind of living in. Like,
Yeah.
what is
I
this
know,
stuff
I know. It's
that
it's reawakening to things we were sort of born into and take for granted, such as gravity or such as
yeah,
consciousness, you know, and just
water being wet, you know.
to yes, to spend a second on, you know, the black box hallucination machine. I read a book that left quite an impression. It was the self-illusion. You know, self-illusion comes up in what maybe it's phrased differently here and there, but self-illusion or illusion of self comes up a lot in Buddhism. One Buddhist scholar I'm a big fan of is Jay Garfield at Smith College, also in Massachusetts.
Love him.
And he wrote a book, what, you know, I've heard a couple of his conversations, which I loved, and you know, he did write a book on self-illusion. But what also left a powerful impression on me was a book called Self-Illusion by Bruce Hood, who's a neuroscientist. I think he is dual at maybe MIT in Cambridge, but he goes on this tour of, you know, at least 100 different studies about how, you know, why do we crave sugar, or why, you know, are the two brain hemispheres actually independent minds operating, and they just it seemingly feels like one thing. And you know, regardless of what the answers to those questions are, just the fact that we don't know, we are in a relationship with consciousness in the brain, but nobody really understands how it all works. And I love that. I love that. That's an open question.
I was you know, I did some digging on your website, and I did love that the picture you have of Chalmers with the kind of
Rene
devil like
Descartes,
inputting things
yeah.
in the little brain, I think, therefore I am. And how, yeah, consciousness, we don't know. We don't know why we have the brains we have, really. And we don't know what accounted for, you know, even like what caused us, what caused Homo erectus to pick its paws up off the ground and just go upright and leave
Yes.
its entire chest cavity exposed to the
Yeah,
world.
yeah.
You know, like what was the impetus for
Yeah.
that? And you know, that's fascinating to me. Like that's, you know, these unanswerable questions, and you know, to me, at least to me, they seem unanswerable. Like, you know, I like staying with those because I do think that, personally speaking, I think questions have a lot more value than answers. And if you
Yeah,
keep tugging at
that's
those
great.
questions, I just think they're it lends that openness that we're talking
Yeah,
about, right?
yep.
That the questions give you that the keys to that openness. The answers, they close the door, right? It's like, okay, yeah, okay, water's wet because it's two particles of two molecules of hydrogen, one oxygen, whatever. But like that doesn't, you know, that doesn't answer the fundamental kind of underneath question that I'm always kind of concerned with. You know, about the ontology or ideology of things. Like, well, why?
Yeah,
You know, why does that?
and what's also nice is not only is there no answer, but there's seemingly we're not even close to anything that might seem like an answer, and I that has a humbling power. Maybe one more thing. I'll you know you start you mentioned you at least we're studying psychology and therapy. Is that still something you practice today?
Yeah, I am a yeah, I'm full time. I have a private practice. So yeah, I am a practicing psychotherapist, and yeah, I really do. I love what I do.
I mean,
It's such a privilege and honor.
I really admire that, first of all, because when I think about, you know, we both looked at a big question, which was how do you get 8 billion people to sort of become curious about these things? But then on the other extreme, just to help people individually wherever they're at, that's the best that we have. So the fact that you're committed to that, not just because it's a genuine concern, but professionally, that's really great. And I guess what I'm curious about is how often are you able to link so much of what we've talked about today, whether it's subtly or not, into the world of helping people one-on-one? Is there ever a bridge? Not that you would say, hey, here's a book on mindfulness, or check out this Buddhism, but it's more sort of one or two clicks removed. It's more just the essence of how to treat people, or how often do those worlds meet? I'm sure for you and your inside of your inner world, they're always the bridge is always there. They're really connected. But how often? Maybe it's hard. Say, if you were direct and trying to say, hey, check out mindfulness, or hey, check out these deeper insights about the self, do those opportunities come up, or is it sort of, they're too distant to really try to tie them together, or maybe it's not wise to try and tie them together?
No, it's largely it does implicitly color a lot of my work. As you say, it's kind of constantly in my background where, I'm sort of gauging whether or not someone would be open to that sort of thing. And I am pretty explicit, I will say, have you encountered this thing called mindfulness? Like it's pretty well established within at least, most of the people that I encounter have at least a glancing kind of working understanding of like what that means. And so I will be pretty explicit, like, hey, have you thought about like a meditation practice, or have you ever encountered mindfulness?
How do, what
And I
what
just,
what do you offer? Because
yeah, go ahead.
if you say, how do you introduce that basically? Is there a specific resource, or do you just start with the topic and kind of see where it goes? And
Yeah, a lot of fishing, a lot of just kind of casting lines and seeing what people bite and seeing what they don't. And, if they resonate and they kind of go with it, then, I kind of walk with them on that. But, if they don't pick it up, they don't pick it up. It's like,
If
I'm not
someone
gonna
were
push it.
interested, would you refer them to a specific, because I think there's so many options here, and all of them are good ones. I'm just curious if you have like a go-to book or resource or anything like that that you might steer someone toward.
Yeah, I really like Bhante Ji's book, The Mindfulness in Plain English. That's a big one, and I also tend to just put people at my trailhead with The Miracle of Mindfulness. I think that's a really straightforward, accessible.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's nothing like your firsthand experience to share that.
I do like to kind of go with what I know and just see how people relate to it. And like I say, if they pick it up and they run with it, great. And if they don't, like that's fine too. I'm not in a position to like be like, no, you have
Yeah,
to.
it seems like the best you can do is just put a few options on the table. People can take it or leave it.
Yeah, that is kind of how I try to frame it. And see where their kind of journey takes them. It is to me, it is a sort of co-created exploration of what is going to help you in your individual context. And then, as you said, like it's constantly informing my kind of view of like as I said earlier, that kind of fungibility. It's like, well, why? Why do you think you need to behave in this way to get your needs met? And like it's
Yeah,
running, it
yeah,
sounds like it's running counter to like what you want to be doing. So like what's happening here inside of you that's causing you to kind of keep going back to this well despite there not being any water in it,
yeah. That I'm sure that's probably being able to see questions that might help someone pull their own thread. That must be quite a powerful continuous
that's a good way
experience
of
you
putting
have.
that. I like that.
Maybe the last thing I'll ask, and you've suggested all sorts of things that I think are great, but if there was any, and maybe it is the fungibility of personhood, but if there's any insight you would wish people in the world to notice, what would it be?
Oh, let's see.
Or maybe it's a question and not an insight. Maybe it's a question that leads to an insight.
I guess, the first thing that comes to mind is why do I think I need to do this? If more people would stop and say, what, why do I think that this is requisite for my being?
This meaning anything that's right in front of a person? Yes, I think that's great.
And you know, no matter what.
No matter what it is, if you pull that string, it'll
To me,
unravel a whole ball of
that's sort of
yarn.
an entryway to some of those bigger questions around personhood, identity, context, culture. Just kind of apply, almost like applying a toddler's mind to ourselves and like why our actions. Well, why? 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 And like if it only takes 4 or 5 turns of that question to really rub up against some really fundamental shit.
I know. You're so right. You're so right. I mean, I guess that's the confounding part about this is when we can talk about this so matter-of-factly. It's like, simply question your behaviors and your identity and watch what happens. But if only it was that easy,
If it wasn't so threatening to so many people on a fundamental level,
Yeah, I guess that's maybe one other thing I'll try to continually be curious about is what is so it's either threatening or just totally uninteresting. I can't figure out which is more powerful to sort of deflect people away from checking this out.
Well, I think all change invites a degree of uncertainty, and whenever you have uncertainty, you want to run back to the sure ground of answers, right? Most people, because that uncertainty brings up the big uncertainty of life and death, right? Like, what happens when we die, or why are we here, or what is this? What happens when we, to me, I think most fundamental anxiety, most anxiety is death anxiety on some level, and uncertainty really highlights that death anxiety.
I was going to ask you explicitly what your feelings were on death, but I sort of was reading in between the lines. It feels like you're sort of comfortable. You were earlier you were referring to challenges that you are certain will come at some time, and sort of in advance being at peace with those things and ready for them. And I'm guessing that extends toward death for you, but you can
Very much.
share.
I do make a point. I don't know if people generally have this. We talked a bit at the top about like kind of the reflexive associations that people have in their minds. And if I don't know if you saw the Barbie movie, but the irrepressible thoughts of death, and the way that like if you introduce death into a conversation, you can almost hear the record skip and like people's faces change, and like there's a tightening that happens. And I personally want to dispel that tightening in my own being and
Yeah,
experience.
and that's a great one. BJ Miller, he wrote a book called A Beginning to the End. He's a palliative care physician. I think he lost both of like I forget which limbs he lost when he was a kid, but he's basically a wheelchair-bound palliative care physician who's been through a lot himself, and he's with people in their final moments. But he says something to the effect of, and I'm sure others sort of say the same, is open yourself up to death and receive its lessons. Meaning, don't tighten up, as you say. Check this out. It's actually has a lot to teach and share. And it is beautiful to think about and perhaps peaceful.
For me, thinking about it really informs, how you live, right? Like if you devote all of your energy to blocking off this fundamental tenet of our existence, there's a real risk that I think you get there and it's like, oh shit, I didn't think about this at all. I just went and I did what I thought I was supposed to do, right? Without ever actually attacking some of those other kind of bigger looming maybes or possibilities that I think, I think it's a quote by Picasso, like, only put off till tomorrow what you're comfortable dying having never done. And granted, I procrastinate with the best of them, but I try to keep an eye toward that sentiment.
I feel fortunate that for some reason I was able to find some comfort in advance with whatever is unfinished being okay. Whether you're not looking to hasten it, certainly, but if it were tomorrow or 10 years from now, whatever I did, I did, and what I didn't, I didn't, and it's fine.
Yeah, that's cool.
But you also raise a good point from Picasso, which is don't squander what precious time you have.
Yeah, and it's up to you to decide maybe sitting and doing nothing is really precious. Maybe doing the thing that you want to do is the right thing. But yeah, I like your attitude of like, well, you know what? And I think maybe that's my attitude as well. Like, well, I'll get to it when I do. And if I don't, like, whatever. There's all sorts of things that aren't going to be done. I'm not gonna, I don't know. Yeah, like, it's not all up to me.
Yeah, and it leaves plenty of room for ambitions and pursuits and fun. It doesn't, because I think an extreme might be, well, it doesn't matter. So why do anything? And you sort of just retreat. But I feel it's personally holding both of those things. So I'm okay in advance with whatever happens and doesn't. On the other hand, time is precious. Let's make the most of it.
It's kind of exactly. It's that middle way, not to be too on the nose with
Yeah, no, that's I
the
really I if
Buddhist
there's a few things in Buddhism I mean again I really admire it, and one of those things certainly is the middle way, because no matter where we look, there are extremes, and I think maybe it's tempting to just latch onto those extremes or latch onto the inverse of the extreme,
Exactly.
but then of course the notion of the middle way is quite powerful in those situations, because it's like, well, where is the middle way? Let me think about that. So I really do love that term and idea.
And reconciling that it's not a fixed point, that it's as with everything, it's constantly moving, it's constantly
Yes.
changing, and there's no kind of, unfortunately or fortunately, there is no sure ground. So really kind of staying in that liminality is to me the kind of the practice, and understanding like where that middle way is between the extremes of all out indulgence or all out asceticism.
Yep. Yeah, practice is an open-ended thing, ongoing.
Definitely.
Well, Jason, this has been great.
Yeah, likewise.
I'll do my best to sort of distill this down into something we can share with each other, and if it felt right, we can share it more broadly. But regardless of what happens there, again, thanks for jumping on. There's a lot of good stuff here to think about. So thank you again.
Yeah, I appreciate the recommendations on, implicit recommendations on the I'll check out the Bruce Hood and the BJ Miller. That sounds really, really fantastic. And yeah, thank you for being open to talking with me. I really appreciate your time and these thoughtful questions.
Awesome. Well, Jason, we'll be in touch soon.
All right, take good care.
All right, you too. Bye.
All right, bye-bye.